Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Neither by sale nor by repudiation is a wife released from her husband. Such we know the law to be, which the Lord of Creatures, Prajapati, made of old. When Draupadi was dragged into the assembly during Duryodhana's gambling match, there was a point of confusion regarding whether or not she was released from her husband. So that was the thing, because if she could be gambled separately, that means she's released from the husband. So the point is, even by sale, even if you sold your wife, you're still connected to your wife. It's not gonna work. So you can take that off your list. You know? Methods to try, you know, like that. So the point is that husband and wife are never. They're never not connected. It's just the way it works. Yeah.
So we can say that when he met Yudhishthir, he sold all his kind of lost all his brothers and himself. So she would automatically.
She was automatically lost. That was her point.
Yeah. So she would always them.
Yeah, like that. You know, so his point is if you haven't lost yourself, then possibly you could discuss whether she would be, you know, become a maidservant. It doesn't mean that she's not under doesn't have her connection of her husband. But if he was already lost, she's automatically lost with him. So that's her point, is that who is lost first? You know, like that. And so, you know, the point was Yudhishthir, but they still couldn't answer the question. So that's why she kept asking, like that. Once is the partition of the inheritance made. Once is a maiden given in marriage. And once does a man say, I will give. Each of those three acts is done only once. Right, so inheritance, you can't give it many times. Once it's divided up and once it's divided, that's the way it is. You can't say afterwards, well, actually, I'd like, no. Once you've done it, it's done. Right, the girl, when she's given, and then that's it. There's not a second time you can give. So if a woman is being married a second time, she's not given away. Like that, because she can only do that once, right? So then she's just for convenience getting married a second time, because then that just gives her some shelter and all that. But it doesn't have the same rules. You know, in other words, if you're doing, you know, like even like the Vedic wedding, then the girl's not given away by that. So that pouring of the water, the hands, that's not done again. Or if it's one of these one, walking down the aisle like that with, you know, the father giving, that's not happening again. You know, someone else brings you down the aisle just to keep you company. That's another thing. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah. When a woman is married, for example, two times or three times, the first husband is the only husband?
Means theirs, means that if you, technically there is no, not there's, how you say, there isn't any disconnection, technically.
Yes.
They may separate, they may not live together, like that. If he dies, then technically also, then there's still no disconnection. But if there's no children and they're young, so then there's the question, she could get married again. But that's only practiced in Kali Yuga. Other ages, they don't bother. But it could be done.
So she can think in her mind that there are few.
No, it's not so much that. It would be means and Mark, because they're not connecting themselves emotionally, so that's broken because of their tradition, according to that. But the point is all the rites that are there for the girl the first time she's married wouldn't be used again. Right? In other words, all the samskaras in the marriage aren't used again. Her being given away is not used again. Like that. But, you know, pouring the puffed rice, putting the foot on the stone, going around the fire, going the seven steps, that's done because that's the actual marriage. But all the other purificatory rites and that are dropped. You know, so remarriage is quite simple, right? Because normally it's not a big thing. You know what I'm saying? You know, if you're Elizabeth Taylor, maybe, but if you're not, then it's not a big thing. You know.
So it's purely material.
It's just for that there's some protection and all that. It's not recommended, but if that's the way it works, then okay, it works like that. But it means, what the point is being here is the maiden is given in marriage. She can't be given in marriage again. She may get married, but she can't be given in marriage. Right? Does that make sense? So the inheritance is once, the girl being given once, and what was the last thing? And I will give. Someone says, I'm giving some charity. Right? That was the problem with Nriga. Right? He gave the cow twice. That was the problem. So these it's saying is that it's only one time. As with cows, mares, female camels, servant girls, buffalo, cows, she-goats, and ewes, it is not the begetter or his owner who obtains the offspring. Even thus, it is with the wives of others. What does that mean? Why does it say, or his owner? No, it shouldn't be or the own or his owner. It means or his previous owner. That should be say that. In other words, whoever has means like let's say the cow. Someone had a cow, he gave it to you. Or you bought the cow, whatever it is. You know? Isn't there a saying he bought the cow? I'm not sure. It's some Americanism or something. Okay. So now that cow happens to be pregnant. Then, when in the new house, then the cow has the calf. Now, the previous owner can't claim, well, no, I was pregnant when I get, so I get the calf. You can't do that. So that's the point, is
who owns the field?
Who owns the field owns the production of the field. That's the point. So the point is here is also, whoever is, means if the lady is married to somebody and they have children, now if she marries someone else, those children belong to who she's married. So who has the field has the children. Right? Unless the children are of age so that they're independent. That's another thing. But if they're under the care of the mother who's with the mother, it's their children. Right? That's who takes care, that's who raises, that's who the other one can't claim. You know, if you want to work out something out of sentiment they want to see, that's another thing. But at the same time, when it comes to inheritance, the actual inheritance of the man goes to his own child, not technically to the children of his wife. Though naturally they would get a share in all that, but as far as the property, who'd own the property, and that would go to his own son, right? Unless they were such that they were as good as, you know, or he didn't have any, then there's another consideration. But the point is if you're taking the emotional considerations aside, then that child, his inheritance will come from his actual father, right? Like that, if there's a problem there. But if he's been integrated into that family and that, then he's as much as that and that's there. But it's not that he would necessarily, he can try to claim both, you know what I'm saying? So these things come up only when you're dealing with legal cases, right? Because this is in the section on domestic law. So these are considerations that come up. People fight over, you know, the children, fight over the inheritance, fight. So these are just simple ways of doing it. Those who have no property in a field but possess seed corn, sowing it in another's soil, do indeed not receive the grain of the crop which may spring up. Right? If I don't have a field, but I have grain, if I plant it in someone else's field, I don't get the grain. I could say, well, it was my seed, it doesn't matter. It's their field. You know, that's how it works. Because you have to establish it somehow.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise, what's the meaning of having the field if everyone can come and grow something in it? You know, it's your field, so whatever grows there, so if that's the rule, no one will come and grow things in your field.
This also deals with the Monsanto who are patenting seeds. Monsanto, this big company, they're patenting gene-modified seeds and they're spreading them, and then they're actually suing farmers for having these seeds grow in their fields.
Yeah, no, they couldn't do that. Yeah.
They're doing that now.
But they should make a class action against them that your weeds are popping up in our
fields.
Yeah. No, it's just they're demons. That's all. They're just absolute demons. If one man's bull were to beget a hundred calves on another man's cows, they would belong to the owner of the cows. In vain would the bull have spent his strength. Thus men who have no marital property in women, but sow their seed in the soil of others, benefit the husband of the woman, but the giver of the seed reaps no advantage. So if somehow or another he has a relation with someone else's wife and a child is born, that child belongs to who is the husband of the wife.
Yes.
And whoever, you know, begot the child, he has technically no legal connection at all. He can't claim this is my son. He has nothing like that. So that's the rule. Because otherwise, then everybody will take advantage of everybody else's facility. So it's just to be avoided.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. You know, that like that, I'll plant something in your land and claim it's mine. You know, you can't do that. No. Regarding ownership, the field is more important than the seed. Right, so in ownership, the field's more important than the seed. In nature, the seed's more important than the field.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Mm.
Right, because in nature, you plant this, means it's just like, I plant an eggplant seed, I'll get an eggplant plant that'll give eggplants.
Mm.
So the seed makes the nature. But if that seed's not in my field, it belongs to whoever's the field is. So ownership is with the field, nature's with the seed. Is that? If no agreement with respect to the crop has been made between the owner of the field and the owner of the seed, the benefit clearly belongs to the owner of the field. The receptacle is more important than the seed. Right? Now, if he claims, okay, you're not taking care of this land, is it all right if I plow it and grow things here? And he says, yes, then you grow things, it's yours, but by agreement. But if there's no agreement, you just see he's not doing, you plow the land, you grow, then he can claim it. But if by a special contract the field is made over to another for sowing, then the owner of the seed and the owner of the soil are both considered in this world as shares of the crop. Right? So therefore, he's growing in your field, but you get a share. And then you work out whatever it is, you know, that everybody's comfortable.
Can the king go and like kind of overrule this? I'm thinking of particularly in Cuba during the embargo, they made a law that said that any field that's not being used, anyone can go and grow something there because they needed to have things grown locally because they didn't have any oil to transport it. So could you?
That's there, but it's still the land would belong to that person, you know, and it should revert back to them. You know, when they have, in other words, who owns the land has the ability, he could plow it, he should be the one. Because if it's just a matter of they want production, right? It's not a matter of the person, you know, it's a matter of him getting it, they just need production.
Yeah.
So you can say that, but his point is it's still the person's field. And, you know, since it's his field, he should get some benefits. Not that he stars, but they're growing nice food in his field.
Yeah.
You know, it means there should be some shares there. If seed be carried by water or wind into someone's field and germinates there, the plant sprung up from that seed belongs even to the owner of that field. Sorry, Monsanto. The owner of the seed does not receive the crop. Right?
Yeah, pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Know that such is the law concerning the offspring of cows, mares, servant girls, female camels, she-goats, and ewes, as well as of females of birds and buffalo cows. Thus, the comparative importance of the seed in the womb has been declared to you. I will next propound the law applicable to women in times of misfortune. The wife of an elder brother is, for his younger brother, the wife of a guru, and the wife of the younger is declared to be the daughter-in-law of the elder. Right? In other words, the elder brother will see his younger brother's wife like a daughter, and the younger brother will see the elder brother's wife like mother. By twice-born men, a widow must not be appointed to cohabitate with any other than her husband. For they who appoint her to another man will violate the eternal law. Right? Because in other words, what they're discussing is niyoga, which is not applicable in Kali Yuga anyway. But even here it said, basically speaking, it's just not used. You know, that's the principle. In the sacred texts, refer to marriage, the appointment of widows. Okay, so this is widows. So widows are never appointed like that. There may be in the case like we see when Parasuram went around and killed all the kings. So after 21 generations, there were no kings. So then the queens, they approached the sages. Right? And so then their children, then they became the next kings. So then everything went very smoothly. They were all quite sattvic, like that. But they weren't widows. Means, well, here in this case, and it's not sure if they were widows, but in other words, the next generation of princesses to come up, there were no princes either, because they, you know, if they were big enough to get married, they were big enough to fight and get killed. So in any case, they ended up like that. But that was used in, you know, that would have been Treta Yuga. But in Kali Yuga, it's just not used. In the sacred texts, which refer to marriage, the appointment of widows is nowhere mentioned, nor is the remarriage of widows prescribed in the rules concerning marriage. So this is the general law, right? Parasuram, not sure if it mentions it. No. Parasuram then mentions that in the Kali Yuga, if they're married, the husband died very young, there were no children, then there's a consideration she could remarry. But other than that, then generally it wouldn't be used.
Yes, is a woman as a child?
Generally, if there's a child, then they wouldn't, you know, get married. You know, so that was the consideration between Madri and Kunti. Because the point is it was a matter of there are children, so someone should take care. Because they both wanted to enter the fire, but someone had to take care of the children. And so then Kunti's point was, you know, you made the mess, so you live with it. You know, I'm going with, you know, my husband. But Madri's point was is that she doesn't have the character of Kunti, so she wouldn't see all the sons as equally. Well, Kunti does, so she's actually the more qualified mother. Right? So that was more of the... This practice, which is reprehended by the learned of the twice-born caste, as fit for cattle, is said to have occurred even among men while Vena ruled. So it seems that a lot of things came up when Vena ruled. And then while he's ruled, and they were stuck with so many things. That chief or royal sages who formerly possessed the whole world caused the confusion of the caste, his intellect being destroyed by lust. Since that time, the virtuous censure that man who in his folly appoints a woman whose husband died to bear children to another man. So in other words, the niyoga was proper when the husband was present, but couldn't have children. Then they may appoint the brother, it means the brother may be brought in to have the children. Does that make sense? But in this age, then everybody gets attached, and this and that, so it's just not used. And the others, it's just a formal thing to have the child, and that's it.
Maharaj, it was a case with Dhritarashtra. It was a case with Dhritarashtra yesterday.
Yeah, that would be the thing. So that means that's Niyoga, yeah.
Yes.
So Vyasadeva, he had the children.
Yes.
Only because, you know, otherwise the line wouldn't go on. Normal people, the line doesn't go on, it doesn't so much matter.
Yes.
But for the kings, then you have to be more careful, because otherwise then the whole kingdom falls apart. So there'll be more of a consideration here with the kings. Brahmins wouldn't bother so much, everybody else wouldn't bother so much. Let no prudent man, after giving his daughter to one man, give her again to another. For he who gives the daughter whom he had before given incurs the guilt of speaking falsely regarding a human being. Right? So it's lying, but in connection with people rather than just things. A man who has business abroad may depart after securing a maintenance for his wife. For wife, even though virtuous, may be corrupted if she be distressed by one of subsistence. The husband went on a journey after providing for her, the wife shall subject herself to restraints in her daily life. But if he departed without providing for her, she may subsist by blameless manual work. So in other words, he arranges things, and she'll just continue with her normal duties in the home and all this and that. But if he didn't, then she can take up work that's not a problem. Like that. And that way then maintain herself.
works, that's not a problem?
You know, something that's just standard, like, you know, you clean, you cook, you do these things, take care of children, so you do that in someone else's house, like that. That would be the standard kind of thing. You know, either there or in relatives' houses, you know, be involved, you know, do some service. And, you know, in other words, you're in the house, but like a member of the family, you have your duties, so you do those in that way, thank you. Or if not, then outside the family. You know, known proper families and that, then you can do it. If for one year let a husband bear with a wife who hates him, but after the lapse of a year let him deprive her of her property and cease to cohabitate with her. Okay. She who shows disrespect to a husband who is addicted to some evil passion is a drunkard or diseased, shall be deserted for 3 months and be deprived of her ornaments or furniture. Right. So it means that kind of thing. You lose all that, because you have to remember is here is the stuff's hers. Mm.
Yes. Yes.
So if you take that away, then it's a problem. In a modern thing, it's not hers, it's just the house. So it doesn't really mean anything. You know, the Vedic thing, it was her stuff. You know, so therefore she looks at how she uses it, she's comfortable with it. So if you take that away, then it's uncomfortable.
The house itself, is that also hers?
No. That means the house would be the husband's.
And then whatever's in it.
But whatever was given her,
okay,
that's hers.
Okay.
If it was the stuff that's already there, then it's the property of the husband. But the point is the wife has so much property, right? She has property from when she was a child that her father gave her, something was given at the marriage ceremony, things that are given to her out of affection. So all that's her stuff. So you just take that away. Right? You know, of course, here they had bigger houses, so you could take it away. She had her own apartment, so you could take it away and put it somewhere else. Now when you have, you know, a one-room flat, really hard to, you know, move it from one side to the other side, you know. Yeah, no, it's...
Cut the budget for something.
You know, no 10 saris a week, you know,
yes.
Cut it down. But she who shows an aversion towards a mad or an outcast husband, a eunuch, one destitute of manly strength, one afflicted with such diseases as punish crimes, shall neither be cast off nor be deprived of her property. In other words, she's married to someone who is totally unqualified.
Yeah.
Then if she doesn't behave nicely with him, meaning in the way of just, you know, being close and affectionate, then there's no, you can't, there would be no punishment there, because it's actually, she's not supposed to be married to be such a person in the first place.
Drunkard is not in that category. Why is that? Drunkard is in the first.
Because sometimes they're not drunk. But if a woman's a drunkard, that's a problem.
The man can be a drunkard.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point is you have to understand this is a general rule. So generally amongst the Brahmin, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas, you wouldn't have that. Occasionally you do. You know, Jagai and Madai, then you had, they were, but you know. But it's more the common persons might have those kind of things. You know what I'm saying? So in other words, the rougher side of things generally is applying within these your more ordinary situations. But it's a general rule, so that's why it's being given. But normally, in your more cultured families, they've arranged things nicely, so these things won't come up.
Mm-hmm.
Right? These aren't things that you have to deal with.
Mm.
But if you're is, this is how you deal with it. Notice it mentions take away her stuff. It doesn't say beat her. You know, does that make sense?
Mm.
That kind of thing.
Punish crimes? What does that mean?
These means that diseases from, you know, very serious crimes that therefore now they've come as physical. You'll see that in the 11th okay. chapter, it mentions what gets what.
Yeah, interesting.
You know what I'm saying? Like you kill a Brahmin, you get tuberculosis.
So you can go point fingers and, oh.
Yeah, well that's generally why you'll find when we get to it, it's all in small print. Yeah. Okay, marriage arrangements for girls. To a distinguished, handsome suitor of equal caste, should a father give his daughter in accordance with prescribed rule, though she have not attained the proper age. Okay, Vriti, when a father gives his daughter in accordance with the prescribed rule, it is known as betrothal. Regarding marriageable age, Srila Prabhupada writes in the teachings of Lord Kapila, like the marriage may be arranged when they're younger, and then when they get older, they actually get married. Nowadays, it isn't so common, but previously, it many times it was there. You see many times, especially in the noble families or aristocratic families, there may be marriages arranged when they're just small children, and it's only after 10, 15 years that then they actually get married. So that can be done, but the point is this distinguished, handsome suitor of equal caste. Right? So that's the whole, yes.
So they didn't really use those alliance marriages,
Some might, but the point was is their qualification was, so that's what it says, equal nature. So the point is if they were a high-grade kshatriyas, they'd marry a high-grade kshatriya. So the point is nature's the same, they know their duties, it will work as a marriage. Right? It's the point is the political element is maybe a consideration, but it doesn't get in the way of their personal development of the relationship. You know what I'm saying? So you wouldn't have, you know, so much like you'd see in your non-Vedic where the political alliances are made, but there's no affection because there they don't know how to perform their duties. So the husband doesn't deal right, so the wife doesn't respond, you know, so it doesn't work out so good. But here is that who you marry, that's who you live with and who you deal with. Does that make sense? So therefore they would make their best effort to make it work. So it didn't really matter. As long as they were distinguished, handsome, and of equal caste, it would work. Does that make sense? Generally, a man should marry at around 24 years of age, and a girl should marry no later than 16. If this is the case, then when the man is 50 years old, his eldest son should be around 25, old enough to take charge of the mother, right? So in other words, then he gets married, he takes care of the family. But the maiden, though marriageable, should rather stop in the father's house until death. Then that the father should ever give her to a man destitute of good qualities. Right, so even though the principle is all girls get married, but better she doesn't get married than marry someone unqualified. Right? So in other words, one should take the trouble to make sure she marries someone qualified. That's the principle. 3 years let a damsel wait, though she be marriageable, but after that time let her choose for herself a groom of equal caste and rank. Right? So this is where that prajapatya marriage comes in. What it means, where the girl chooses. It doesn't mean she goes out in the street. It means as the father would check and see who's this and that through his friends and relatives, you know, find suitable persons, she would do the same thing. The difference is she's organizing it instead of the father. But it has to be someone that the father would approve. Then it's prajapatya. But if it's not, then it's gandharva. Vriti, if after 3 years of waiting the father's not found a suitable husband for her, then a daughter may arrange for other relatives or associates to find her a husband. She is not advised to find her own husband. That is the Gandharva rite. Right? So she may see, she may hear about like that, and then through her, you know, good offices find out. Does that make sense? If, not being given in marriage, she herself seeks a husband, she incurs no guilt, nor does he whom she weds. Because otherwise someone may say, oh, but she's not a good girl, she found her own husband. No, but if it wasn't properly arranged, then what's the problem? Point is she's supposed to get married. So it's either the father arranges it, or if he can't do it, then she arranges it. Right? But if nobody can be found as proper, then she just stays in the father's house. Right? So in other words, the father should be very eager to find her a suitable match, but he's not eager to get rid of her.
Yes.
A maiden who chooses for herself shall not take with her any ornaments given by her father or her mother or her brothers. If she carries them away, it will be theft. Kriti, when a marriage is arranged in this way, the bride may not take the ornaments the family gave as part of the attempts at arranging the marriage. Right? In other words, what was they were making for the arrangement of their arrangement, she can't take that ornament. Right? In other words, if they give her stuff, that she can take. But she can't demand that father was going to arrange something, so now that she gets. She can't take that. But if the father appreciates, because you may have the thing is the father very much appreciates the boy. Right? So naturally he's going to give all those things. But now let's say he doesn't appreciate the boy. The point is that she can marry him anyway. But she can't take the ornaments that the father had for the arrangement, for his arrangement of the marriage. Does that make sense?
I don't understand. She did all the arrangements herself because her father didn't do that.
Yes. So but that means that she can't use the father's arrangements.
But she did it because she didn't like father's arrangement or because he didn't do anything?
He didn't do anything, but it's still two different endeavors. She can't claim her father's endeavor for herself. You understand like this. He's trying to arrange the marriage. He's bought gold and everything for that marriage. He can't find anybody for her to marry. So she arranges to marry somebody. Right? She can't claim that she gets the gold that the father arranged for the marriage. You know what I'm saying?
She did all the endeavor.
But she did the endeavor to find the husband. What's that got to do with the gold? She didn't make the endeavor to get the gold. The father made the endeavor to get the gold.
But he didn't make the endeavor to find the husband.
But they're two different things. You know what I'm saying? They're two separate categories. You know what I'm saying? So the point is the natural thing is if the father is very happy with that, then all that facility would go with her. But what happens if she makes an arrangement with somebody he doesn't really approve of? You know what I'm saying? So why should he be obliged to give all those things of his arrangement? You know what I'm saying? So it's very natural. So it's not by force, and she demands that she gets it or she takes it because that was supposed to be. You know what I'm saying? In other words, she has whatever's given as affection. So she can't have the stuff based on what would be given at the marriage because it wasn't. It was supposed to be given. So if it's not given, then it wasn't given to her at the marriage and it wasn't given out of affection. So it's not her property. But if out of affection, then the father gives that, so then that's what's given at the time of marriage. So then that's hers. Like that. You know, because you have to take into consideration is that who she finds or the arrangements the father may not appreciate. Does that make sense? Or maybe he made some arrangements and means he was making those arrangements and let's say they lost all their money, so now he wants to use that gold to maintain the family. She can't claim, no, that's mine because of the marriage. You know, so there may be so many arrangements. I mean, so many situations. So the point is if she makes her own arrangement, that's a separate endeavor than what her father was making the arrangements. She can't claim it's automatic. Right? Does that make sense? You know, because then where's the affection? You know, that so it's not actually very solid.
That's the obligation of the father to find.
Yes, but that's to find the husband. But to give ornaments and that's according to his, his facility, you know, his ability or his affection. You know what I'm saying? So like that. So then you have to consider that element. You know? It means it should naturally work that way because she should find someone that the father would be pleased with anyway. And so then naturally these things would come along. But much of the time, you know, the girls find someone that the father doesn't really like. So she can't expect that he will, you know, give all that facility. Like that. Does that make sense? Later on, if it proves that he comes out to be a nice guy and that, he may give it anyway. You know, but, you know, instead of a marriage present, it'll be birthday or this or that, you know. So like that. So the point of the Vedic is that relationships are the most important. Not the legal elements, right? So the legal elements have to consider how people would actually respond. But there's the normal how a human should respond, you know? Because otherwise you can say, no, but I planted stuff in the field that's mine. That's how you'd respond, but that's not how you're supposed to respond. Right? Does that make sense? Yes?
About this information of marrying early, marrying the daughter early.
Well, there's betrothal and there's marriage. So the betrothal can be made early, but marriage would be made at a suitable time.
Mm-hmm. So the betrothal. sometimes it's difficult with the Western.
I wouldn't bother with it. Yeah. Like that. Not in this generation. Leave it a few generations in the West. Because the thing is the similarity of nature is so different that you can't tell, you know, and the value systems can change so quickly. You know what I'm saying? But you have community where generations they've done in a certain way, you know how they'll respond. So therefore someone else from the same kind of generational standard, then you can make the arrangement earlier. Right? Does that make sense? Now also, the earlier marriages are more important for girls that are more attached. So generally, the as you go down the varnas, then the marriage would be made, the betrothal would be earlier. But as you go up, it's not as important. Like for the Brahmins, it's not so important that the girl is already, the betrothal or engagement is already done early. Because they have that kind of intelligence and sense control that they can wait until the actual time and then at that point start to worry about it. Does that make sense? But those who, when the nature is more attached, then generally the earlier it's arranged, then they don't get, they're peaceful because they know they have a husband. Does that make sense? You know, so just like as you go down in the varnas, they have more stuff. You know, they're more worried about security and the up you go, the less they are. Right, so in the same way is that the Brahminical, as they don't worry about the security the next day, so they don't worry about that until the time is there. But that doesn't mean they're irresponsible, it just means the girl's busy focusing on education and things like that. Does that make sense? Like, well, before that, they're not worried so much about education, they're worried about getting married and situating themselves and having a facility and all that. Right? But your Brahmins and Kshatriyas, that's not so much the focus. It's more on being qualified to be able to perform your duty. Does that make sense? The husband receives his wife from the gods. He does not wed her according to his own will. Doing what is agreeable to the gods, he must always support her while she is faithful. Right. Doing what is agreeable to the gods indicates following scriptural regulations concerning household life. So in the marriage ceremony, what we're saying when it's done that first time is that the groom takes the bride up to the fire and says he's receiving her from, it means, who's first? I think Soma's first. It means she's under the care of Soma. And then Soma gives her to Gandharva, and then Gandharva gives her to Agni, and then from Agni the husband receives the girl, like that. So he's actually receiving the girl, it's not by his own will, it's because he's being given, because there's that point of this mantra that's chanted, because Soma is, because you know, Soma is, how you say, nourishment, and you know, that pleasantness, niceness, you know, like it says, the king should have the quality of Soma. People, like, you know, when they see them, they're happy to see him. You know, it's just he's attractive, he's nice. So like that, little girls are attractive and nice. Then Gandharva, then they become refined and they develop all kinds of nice skills and everything like that. Then Agni, right? To be mothers were women created, and to be fathers men. Religious rites, therefore, are ordained in the Vedas to be performed by the husband together with his wife. Right? So all religious performances are done by grihasthas. Brahmacharis don't have any. Right? The vanaprastha sannyasis don't have any. They have their nitya kriyas, but they don't have any these other things. The samskars are all done by the grihasthas. Right? The others, they don't have these elements. So because there's no wife, therefore there's no ritual. They just have their daily sadhana. Does that make sense? Impropriety of the nuptial fee, because sometimes you have the thing where the boy's side of the family gives money to the girl's side, and that way secures. So in the Vedic standard, even a Shudra ought not to take a nuptial fee when he gives away his daughter, for he who takes a fee sells his daughter, covering the transaction by another name. You're selling your daughter, but you're calling it something else. So in the Vedic consideration, it shouldn't be used. But there's laws concerning it, because people do use it. Right? So the point is if the fee has been taken, and then it means and you promise the one girl but give another, like that you can get the fee back. All these different things are there. So there are rules about the fee. But that's only because people do it. But it's not recommended. Does that make sense? So that's the point, is the laws say what's the actual standard, but then they also deal with when people act below the standard. Neither ancients nor moderns, who are good men, have done such a deed that after promising a daughter to one man, they have given her to another. Right? So that's not, means you promise the daughter to get married, it's that girl, not, you know, then you substitute another daughter. Right? Nor indeed have we heard, even in former creations, of such a thing as the covert sale of a daughter for a fixed price called a nuptial fee. Right? Like that. So, in other words, these things they haven't heard that are done. Because these are where you run into problems. In these two things. Because much times in the marriage, it means they've seen the girl, but the boy hasn't seen. And when she comes out, she's covered. So when she comes out, when she's uncovered, then you may find it's a different girl. So for that time, you can actually stop the marriage. You know, stuff like that. But that means it's mentioned here because people do it. You know, what to say.
Yeah.
All right, what about
what about if the boy is different?
But in one marriage, his face is covered with flowers. He could.
Yeah, possibly. Maybe that's why they use that big hat, right?
Yeah.
No, I mean, the Dowdy.
Now, if you had a Ku Klux Klan marriage, now definitely there you could have made the sweet.
Interesting surprises.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead, sir. Sorry.
Dowdy. We hear about the boy's family received. I think we have discussed
it. Means it's the dowry is a gift to specifically for the girl. That's there for the couple to use, right? So, because it's not money from the boy's family. That's what's done for regular maintenance. But what's given to the girl, that's basically inheritance. I mean, stuff you want specifically just for her, that's given to her directly. And that's directly her wealth. But there's a dowry given that is there for the couple to work together, but it's specifically hers. So if there's something, there's also laws, if something happens in the marriage thing, then the girl can get that dowry. But it's not that she can't get, like the husband goes away, it's not that she can get control of that and maintain herself and stuff. It's not that it becomes the boy's. In the modern practice, it becomes the boy's family. But it's not, it's actually for the couple to use together. Like that. But if they're not going to continue properly, the contract goes back to the girl. Does that make sense? It doesn't go to the boy, so it's not that, you know, you burn your wife and you get the dowry. No, it doesn't work like that. They mean that's what they do nowadays, but that's what we're saying, is that there are people that do all these weird things. They're not supposed to, but they do them. You know? One could say, no, but that's the Vedic custom. In the West, you're not supposed to kill people, but they do it. You know? Does that make sense? So it's just, there are people who just don't follow the rules. The rules are there, but they just don't follow. Summary of the law for husband and wife. Let mutual fidelity continue until death. This may be considered as the summary of the highest law for husband and wife. Right? So if that's there, all the other things will fall into place. Like that. Let man and woman united in marriage constantly exert themselves that they may not be disunited and may not violate their mutual fidelity. Right, so it says constantly exert themselves, because it's not that it'll just happen automatically. Right? Marriage means it's work. Right? Just like, let's say you have a business. It's not that you can sometimes work, sometimes not work, and it's going to flourish. No, as you work, it flourishes. When you don't work, it doesn't. So marriage is the same. You put in the effort, it works. You don't put in the effort, it doesn't work. So they should act in such a way that it works. That's the rule, right? That's the summary. Thus has been declared to you the law for a husband and his wife, which is intimately connected with conjugal happiness, and the manner of raising offspring in times of calamity. Learn now the law concerning the division of the inheritance. Right. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Right. So in other words, if this is all nice, then the conjugal happiness is nice, and everything with the children works out nice. Right. But if you don't follow these things, then the relationship breaks down. Then there's all kinds of, then conjugal happiness is not there. And then all the anxieties and that come up over the children. So in other words, they exert themselves, it works out very nice. You know, it's storybook. Mm-hmm. But if they don't, then it falls apart and it's a big mess. You know, that's
horrible.
The... Yes. Yeah. Scary movie 7. Okay, now inheritance. After the death of the father and of the mother, the brothers being assembled may divide amongst themselves in equal shares the paternal and maternal estate. I'm not sure about the maternal, because that means that you're talking about sisters and stuff like that. Because maternal never goes to the boys. The women's property always stays with women. Like that. For they have no power over it while the parents live. Right. So in other words, the father's there, then it's his estate. Though the sons are living with him, he's taking care. So that's what they're gaining from it. Now, if he dies and the mother's there also, then they would, the tendency was making here, they would cooperate together. Right? Live as one unit, because for the mother, it's all the sons and they're all one family. Just as when the father was there, they'd all be together. Right? But if mother and father are both dead, then if they want, they can divide the estate and live separately. But otherwise, they wouldn't do that. They would stay together.
So the eldest son doesn't have any. He doesn't have any. Like,
no, or the oldest can take the whole thing. Means they can do one of two things. Either the oldest, like the father was there and they all lived under him. The oldest takes the estate and he maintains all the other brothers.
Yeah.
Or they may divide it and live separately as they please. Right. Okay. Immediately on the birth of his first son, a man is called the father of a son and is freed from the debt to the mains, right? Because you have a debt to the mains, so when you have a son, then that debt is taken care of. Right? That makes sense.
Yeah. So brahmacharis.
If you're a brahmachari, it doesn't matter.
It just doesn't matter. No.
Yeah.
If you don't have sons,
huh?
The debt continues.
Well, then the daughters, they have sons, and then they take care of it. Right? So putra or putri, but the putri will have putra, like that, so then it works out. But these are for, that's why if one's a devotee, these aren't so important. Because the point is the forefather is Krishna. So you're worshipping Krishna, so therefore everybody else is taken care of. But if you're not worshipping Krishna, then these apply. Right? So that's why where they're not worshipping Krishna, and if they don't follow these, then they actually have so much problem, because they're not taking care of the forefathers. So they're living in the estate that the forefathers made. So they're living by the name and position and wealth that the forefathers worked hard for. But they're not giving anything back to them in the way of the sacrifice to the mains. So therefore, then the mains will fall from their position and they'll fall from their own position. That's why you see, even though they have stuff, it all disappears. Right? You know, generally you never see it gets past the grandson. You know, generally in the grandson's life when it all falls apart. But now if they're taking care, or they're acting piously, then it will continue. So those families that you see, they've been rich for generations, they're behaving in a better way. Does that make sense?
There's one family in West Bengal who were told that as long as they built temples, they would always have money.
Yeah. Oh, Birlas. Yeah, Birlas are always building.
That's all they're doing.
The big one in Calcutta is one in Hyderabad. There's all over. There's always a building.
And they have money.
Yeah.
So, it works.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they're always coming. Big temples, not little.
Yeah, yeah.
It's build one next to it.
Yeah.
The whole street. Like that. No, they build big, very opulent.
Yeah.
That son alone on whom he throws his debt and through whom he attains immortality is begotten for the fulfillment of the law. All the rest they consider the offspring of desire. In other words, having one child, that's considered you cleared your debt. More than that, that's up to you.
No, you're just showing off.
Yeah, that one family, father go to, they went to the, you know, lunch or, you know, program at someone's house, and they come and they show all the children, there's this one and this one and this one, go through the whole thing, and then after he finished, the man kind of went away, then Prabhupada turned to the other sannyasis and says, yes, he's proud of his sex life, you know, so showing off, yes, this child. But at the same time, in the marriage ceremony, he says, you know, may there be 10 children, so there'll be 11 men in the house, right? The father and 10 sons. So, you know, it's just, that's how, one, in other words, one's getting married generally for the purpose that one is trying to fulfill desires, so that one has many children, that's not a problem. But technically, according to the law, you only need to have one.
One boy.
Yeah, one child. Yeah, so. But otherwise, the daughter also, because then she has a son, they'll take care of the right. The point of this, why this is division of inheritance. Mm-hmm. But it's discussing this. Why is it discussing about the rights to the forefathers?
So he's the one who's going to do this.
The person who gets the inheritance is the one who does the rights. Mm-hmm. Or you can say the one who does the rights, he gets the inheritance. Mm-hmm. That's the point. It goes together. So in other words, if it's my money, why should I give it to someone who's not going to, therefore, as a forefather, take care? Mm-hmm. You understand? So even on all these business material things, it's all very just, but you can see it's all very business-like. Mm-hmm. That's the problem with karma. Mm-hmm. Right? Because everything has some reason why it's being done. Well, devotion is being done simply to please Krishna. That's the unique. Okay, it's two different things. Hearing this machine, and then hearing him how he takes care of the cows. I'm just thinking, that cow is making a very strange sound. Okay. As a father supports his son, so let the eldest support his younger brothers. And let them also, in accordance with the law, behave towards their eldest brother as sons behave towards their father. That would be the natural thing. So if there's, you know, 10 sons there, then the eldest one, he will take the position of the father and run the estate and maintain the other 9. So that means they're going to get married, they're going to have children, so he'll be managing that whole thing. So that's, you know, so he has the whole thing, but he has to take care. It's not that he's the eldest, he gets everything and kicks everybody else out. No, that won't work.
Yeah. I'm maybe not connected, but we can see that in India still the sons, they do respect their parents and everything, and it comes kind of naturally.
Yes.
But they, in the West, no matter how much in them we put in it, it always comes out pretty badly.
Because it's association. It's not that, because the point is those children that have that respect for their parents, they also associate with other families and children that have respect for their parents.
Association?
Yeah, it's pretty much association. Because the point is for children, it's how they don't know, so however people deal, that's what they do. You know, in other words, they think that's how everybody does it. And only when they go to the Karmi school, then they find out everybody else doesn't do it like that. And then they get harassed for doing it like that. Then they change. Like that. You know, unless it's someone like Vena, who's just bad from the beginning, right? But, you know, that's not so often. But it happens. Like that. But generally, it's just how others deal. So that's why means one may say this and that about, you know, everybody can move freely and this and that. Yes, but then you get a very common, whatever is the lowest common denominator of that whole group interacting, that's what you're going to have. You know, so if no one wants to follow the higher principles, then their association will be based on lower ones. So that means that's what they'll be acting, that's how their children are acting, and so everything just drops. You know, so this idea, no, we're just being natural or being honest, like that. But animals are being natural and honest. So you want to be natural and honest? Hey, be an animal. human beings meant for control and regulation and trying to uplift, like that. So, you know. Because if you were being natural and honest, there's not practically no kid on the planet who'd like to go to school. But they go to school. Why? Well, that's you know, you're forcing, you're regular. It's not, but in the philosophy, when it comes to anything Vedic, oh, we're just being honest, we're being straight. You know, it's not. The eldest son makes the family prosperous, or on the contrary, brings it to ruin. The eldest is considered among men most worthy of honor. The eldest is not treated with disrespect by the virtuous. So no one disrespects the older brother. Right? He's always, because he represents the father. So even other you know, associates in that, you know, when they were dealing with the father, when his son now is there, and that they would deal properly because he's the eldest son, he represents the father. Right? Within the family, they'll deal with him that way. Outside the family, they would deal that way. So always the eldest son is dealt with proper respect.
What if he's crazy?
What if he's crazy? that will come up, but we dealt with it before. If he's crazy, then his wife can neglect him if she wants. Mm. That doesn't mean she doesn't feed him, but it just means she's not overly, makes an over-endeavor
from a distance.
Like that. If the eldest brother behaves as an eldest brother ought to, he must be treated like a mother and like a father. But if he behaves in a manner unworthy of an elder brother, he should yet be honored like a kinsman. Right? Does that make sense? So in other words, mother and father, because he's respected, so what he says is what everybody does. But if he doesn't behave like that, then he's a kinsman. He's a family member. So he's dealt according to how you deal with a family member. Mm-hmm. So you don't show him the respect, but you show him the due consideration. Okay, living separately. Either let them thus live together, because it's been explaining about living together. It opens that they can either divide the wealth or share it. And then it goes into, the point is whoever takes care of the forefathers, they get the inheritance, right? And then so the eldest is worthy of honor, but now it'll discuss living separately. Either let them thus live together or apart, if each desires to gain spiritual merit. For by their living separate, their merit increases. Hence, separation is meritorious. Right? Now, this is not in the regular consideration. This is the consideration is that, let us say you have a Brahmin family, right? And so you have the five brothers. Now, as a family, they'll do one yajna. Right? They'll do one worship of the forefathers. They'll do one, everything will be one. So that means everybody's getting one-fifth. But if they separate, then each one is doing their own yajna, so they're getting the full benefit. So it says for spiritual merit, then separation is worthwhile. Materially, no, then they should stay together. Right? So it's only those who would be spiritually, because then also if they're separate like this, then there's less involvement. Right? So then there's less craziness of family interaction, all these different things like that. So then they can focus more just on their sadhana and everything like this. But their family, they could cooperate together and everything like this, but they don't have to, over every little thing and what room is used and what and how the money is shared and all this. No, because they just make their own way. Yes?
But at, say, Mangalarashi, we hear that whoever is watching is getting the same spiritual benefit as the pujari.
Yeah. But the point is they're all getting the benefit, but it is one family. But the point is in this way, then they're doing five yajnas. Mm. So
yes,
that means each one is making that full endeavor, so that endeavor they're getting more benefit for.
Okay.
Does that make sense? But it's only if it's consideration of the spiritual benefit.
But for me, still it's...
Because the point is they'll all come and watch, but that's all they'll do. Mm. Well, if they're doing the things, they'll have to go out, get the ingredients, prepare the thing,
okay,
do the
so
whole thing.
Be,
You know what I'm
saying?
So in other words, you're watching the pujari, you're getting the benefit of him offering the arti.
Yeah.
You're not getting the benefit of him preparing the plate and
exactly.
You know, arranging all the deity outfits.
Yeah.
That you're not getting the benefit of. Like that.
Yeah.
But that's the part that no one wants anyway. So
no, exactly.
No one's worried about it anyway. They want,
you come and watch him do that?
Put a glass wall up on the... never would see anyone. Then they could be selling pizza.
Yeah,
I think he'll take those ones to match with the scissor.
What?
He took those? Nah, that's stupid. I wouldn't take those. More pizza? No.
A lot of benefit.
Yeah, so definitely. Yeah, I'll suggest that, about putting in glass walls so he can watch all the pujaris doing everything. And then when the pujari takes Mahaprasad, then you can watch the same benefit, right? You know? Yeah. But to the maiden sisters, the brother shall severally give portions out of their shares, each out of his share 1/4 part. Those who refuse to give it will become outcasts. Right? So maiden sisters means they're not married, because when they get married, then that's when the father gives something. But the father is not there to give. So all the brothers, so if there's 5 brothers, each one gives 1/4 of their share. Right? So she ends up with, 5/4, right? So they only end up with 3/4. So she ends up doing the best, right? So the more brothers, the better. Right? So you can imagine the Duryodhana's sister, right? One sister, 100 brothers, right? She'd do real well. Right. Okay. On failure of sons. But whatever may be the separate property of the mother, that is the share of the unmarried daughters alone. Right? So in other words, the girls get out of the brother's share, they get something, but what was the mother's, that is divided up amongst the unmarried girls. There's no question, the boys don't get anything from that. You know, because what are they going to do with the saris anyway? That's there, still, but it was the mother's one. The girls just think, oh, that's not so good, and this is that, but the daughters will think, this is my mother's sari. And the son of an appointed daughter shall take the whole estate of his maternal grandfather, who leaves no son. Mm. Right? So this thing is then the son of the daughter, she takes the grandfather's estate. So in other words, the estate doesn't go to the daughter, it goes to the grandson. Like that. Right. Because the son delivers Trayate, his father, from hell, called Put. He was therefore called Putra, a deliverer from Put, by the self-existent Swayambhu himself, right? Because he does the rites to the maid. Okay, the 12 types of sons. Among the 12 types of sons of men whom Manu sprung from the self-existent Swayambhu, and enumerates, 6 are kinsmen and heirs, and 6 not heirs, but kinsmen, right? So in other words, all 12 are kinsmen, but only the first 6 are considered heirs. The other 6 are just family members. They don't share in the inheritance. Right? It's not that they're not taken care of. That's why it mentions their kinsmen. Just like the unmarried daughters, they're not heirs, but they get a quarter of their brother's, whatever the estate is. The legitimate son of the body, the son begotten on a wife, the son adopted, the son made, the son secretly born, and the son cast off, are the 6 heirs and kinsmen. The son of an unmarried damsel, the son received with the wife, the son bought, the son begotten on a remarried woman, the son self-given, and the son of a Shudra female, are the 6 who are not heirs but kinsmen. Right, then he'll go into describing each one. Means the first one is the husband has begotten the son. The second one is the brother of the husband has begotten the son. So that's Niyoga.
That's what was the case with Vidura,
like, was the kinsman? Yes, he's kinsman. Right, because he's begotten on Shudra, son of a Shudra's female. So he's kinsman, but he's not an heir to the throne.
The son bought.
He's an heir. I mean, he's a kinsman.
Yeah, Okay, well, bye, son.
Interesting.
I'm just saying, coming from that part of the world, I think he would be more familiar with it. But no?
Slave?
Hmm? Slave? No. It means that the man can't, he doesn't have a son. Let's say he's a rich man or something like that, and someone else has, you know, somebody or he likes them. So he says, I'll give you some money, let him be my son. Right? So he's raised as your son. He's not it's not a slave. This is not talking about slaves.
It's not adopted?
That may be also. Or it may be just he's there, you adopt him. But the point is that means you've done, but how you arranged it, that also is a consideration. Like that. Means it'll get into detail here. Description of the 12 sons. Him whom a man begets on his own wedded wife, let him know to be the legitimate son of the body, Aurasa, the first in rank. He who is begotten according to the peculiar law of the Niyoga, on the appointed wife of a dead man, of a eunuch, or of one diseased, is called a son begotten on a wife, Kshetragya. Right. So that's here it says the peculiar law of Niyoga. In other words, it's legal, but it's a strange law, you know. Yeah, but it'll give some detail. So Vritti, Parasara Muni states, 4:18, sons begotten by a man on another's wife may be divided into two classes, Kunda and Golaka. A child begotten on another man's wife by a person during the lifetime of a husband is called a Kunda, while the one begotten after a husband's demise is called a Golaka. Just in case you were confused about who was the Kunda and who is the Golaka. That boy equal by caste, whom his mother or his father affectionately give, confirming the gift with a libation of water in times of distress to a man as a son must be considered as an adopted son. So here he's given. Or the other one then he's bought. Right. In other words, they're not interested to give, but if there's money there, okay. So that means he's really desperate and they're not very cultured. You know, so therefore the quality of it's there. But here it's that they gave out of affection. Out of affection they gave, because he has affection for the child or that, he has no, you know, so then, you know, like Kunti, she was given out of affection. So she becomes the full, you know, it means, you know, how you say it. Yeah, the nature is of a higher quality, you know, so that goes on. Adopted son, Datrima. But he is considered a son made, Kritrima, whom a man makes his son, being equal by caste, equated with the distinctions between right and wrong, and endowed with filial virtues. In other words, the parents aren't giving him, but somehow or another he just becomes the son. But he's there and the man adopts him. But he has equal nature, he has good qualities, good virtues, then only he's considered like this. So it's like also adopted, but it's a different than he was given with that. Because we see the element of relationship and affection and the family bond. Well, this one, there is no family bond. There's no connection with the parents. If a child be born in a man's house and his father be not known, he is a son born secretly in the house, Gudotpana, and shall belong to him of whose wife he was born. In other words, husband and wife are married and somehow or another the wife has a child, but it's not of that house, right? So then that's secretly born, because generally speaking, then no one would know what happened, really, like that. So he's also part, because then that previous rule of who has the field, then the child is there. Him whom a man receives as a son after he has been deserted by his parents or by either of them is called a son cast off. Right, so the son is thrown out, or somehow way or another, just the family drops him, or they can't take care, and they just desert him. So taking in such a person like that, that's also. So he sees these it means, in other words, the one that is begotten by the father on his wife, that's considered the proper son, the full son. The other five are someone else's son, But they're basically speaking adopted. But the quality of the relationship in that is considered good. So therefore, then they would be in a good position. Okay. So we'll end here. Tomorrow we'll continue with the six kinsmen.
And it is degrading in this.
Yeah, it's going down. Means, in other words, the higher up it is, the better it is. So each one lower is considered less than the one previously.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Right, means in other words, the boy is given out of affection, means he's had affection, so he'll be strong in that department. The other one, they've developed the affection, but you don't know about the family background. Right, then down from that, then it's the wife gives birth to the child, so it is the wife's child. So there's going to be some proper affection there. The last one, he's been cast out, so there's not proper affection. But you can develop that with him, but it's still, he doesn't have the background of it, so it won't be as good as someone who had a background in affection. Is that?